since we're just...
And this is Ray Hill in the radio studio of KPFT Houston HD2 channel. And tonight our Execution Watch program centers around Gary James Johnson. We're waiting word for... We need to go here and here. Are you there, Gloria?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm trying to get you on the board, so that's not coming in yet.
Oh, okay.
I can hear you on the telephone, but I can't hear you on the radio yet. But I will. Are you tried again?
Okay.
No. Let's see if I can get. You tell me something. I'm trying to make it happen. Where do I get Gloria?
Uh-huh.
There you are, Gloria. I've got you on the air. Okay, I found the right button at last. What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, the second execution in 5 days is going on. The state of Texas is going headfirst into the new year with the legal lynchings here. The media walked across the street about 3 minutes ago, and then quite a large group of people followed them. I know that the prisoner, the man being executed tonight, is Gary Johnson, and he's allowed five people, but there must have been 10 people that walked in, so I'm assuming they are various yahoos and sheriffs or DAs or...
Well, shouldn't. Those should have come in with the other team, which comes by a circuitous route.
Well, I don't know how they did it or what exactly happened, but there was a large group that followed about 60 seconds after the media.
Was there more than one media?
Yes. Oh, yeah. There was four or five media.
Well, then you have the family group, and I just do not believe that the deputy sheriffs and the other people, rooters for the other side, would come from across that street. I think that those folks would have come through the from the back gate, like.
Right. I've never noticed that before. Now I know that sometimes when we're here, they are training other states or even other countries on how to lethally inject people.
Okay.
But they don't usually go in with the
family. They wouldn't go in with the family either. They might go in with the media, but not the family.
Right. So I don't know what that was about. Now, it was interesting because earlier a large group of people with their boots and cowboy hats and so on came walking down, what is this, Avenue I, and I thought it was some yahoos from the university, perhaps, but this is a Walker County case.
Yeah.
So perhaps, and they walked, one of the guards stopped them, and it looked like they were motioning them to go down to the other side. so I can't see if any...
By the other side, you mean where the police were gathered last week?
Right, the other side of the block.
Yeah.
That the Walls unit is on. I can't see anybody down there.
Okay, Gloria, how many folks have you there at the vigil?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 of us.
Seven of you, and
there's professors here, and Carl Rodenberg from Germany's here, and Ward is here, and a couple of women who drive up from Spring, and a couple other guys I don't know.
Okay, Gloria.
We've got a decent crowd, and we're not totally frozen tonight.
Yeah, well, the process has begun, and you will get in touch with Elizabeth if you have anything to report.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Gloria Ruback, and Gloria is at the vigil in Huntsville. So we're back in the studio. Jim, tell us about this case.
All right, Terry Johnson lived in Missouri, whichever you call it, and he moved to Texas and went to work. One of the jobs he had while he was in Texas, he worked at a little ranch called a Triple Creek Ranch outside of Huntsville. And I couldn't find any details on why he's no longer working there, but after he became unemployed, he and another brother by the name of Terry Johnson decided to go to the ranch and rob it, and or at least to burglarize it. So they drove out one evening in their pickup truck, and when they get up to the gate to go in, there were some neighbors across the way called Bill and Shannon Ferguson, who were next-door neighbors at the Triple Creek Ranch. And at the time, nobody was home at the Triple Creek Ranch. Well, when the Fergusons saw him go through the gate, they didn't think much about it. But what happened is that Terry Johnson cut the headlights off their pickup and went up toward the ranch house, and this drew their suspicion. So what they did, they called the foreman of the ranch, a man by the name of James Hazelton, and told him that they thought there was a burglar in process, somebody's out there to steal something. About 15 or 20 minutes later, James Hazelton and his brother-in-law arrive at the ranch, and they can't get in the gate. And so they drive to another location and get in the gate from another way. And when they got inside, the Fergusons heard a shot after they got inside the ranch house. the ranch property. And after the shot, several more minutes passed, and then they heard a man begging for his life. And they heard another series of shots at that point. And, of course, at this point, the Fergusons called the police. When the police arrived, they found James Hazelton, his brother-in-law. Both had been shot more than three times, been shot with two different weapons. And apparently the way the case broke, both these men went back to Missouri. And later on, the killings occurred in April. And in August, and they go back to Missouri in August, or in the latter part of August in the fall of 1986. And while they were there, there are three other Johnson brothers, one by the name of Tracy, one by the name of Randy, one by the name of Ricky. All three of them end up testifying at trial. And what Randy tells the jury in Huntsville, that his brother came up to him, his brother Gary came up to him and gave him a .44 caliber pistol and asked him to destroy us. He said he'd been involved in a multiple murder in Houston, and asked his brother to destroy the pistol, gave the pistol to his brother. Then another brother, he admitted committing the murders. He said that he and his other brother Terry had gone to the ranch to rob it, and they got surprised by two guys, and that Terry got them distracted, and he shot one of them. After he shot one, they chased the other one down, brought him back to the barn, put him on his hands and knees, and put a gun in his mouth and shot him several times. Shot him once in the back of the through the mouth, then shot him two or three more times thereafter. And apparently both men participated in the shootings. They didn't. And apparently the major actor in this particular case was Gary Johnson. And so all the brothers testified against Terry Johnson, and testified against Terry and Gary Johnson in this case. Terry Johnson gets convicted not of capital murder, but he gets convicted of straight murder and is given a 99-year sentence.
Was that one of those testify for a lighter sentence?
Terry didn't testify. Terry was a co-defendant. The other brothers were never involved. They were living in Missouri at the time, and the other three brothers were never involved. The only involvement they had was when Gary Johnson gave the pistol to his brother, Terry, I mean, Tracy kept the gun rather than destroying. He later turned it over to authorities. And ballistics tests showed that the bullets taken out of the body of both victims had been fired from that .44 caliber pistol.
But earlier it said that they were shot by two different guns.
Right. The other brother did some shooting, too. And that's how he was. I don't know why. I couldn't find out whether the other brother's case was reduced to murder. He did not testify against his own brother. Terry and Gary were the two shooters, and so for some reason Terry does not get capital murder charge, but he gets a murder charge, and Gary's the one that gets a capital murder case, and he's the one convicted for capital murder. Now, what's interesting about this case in this sense? There was not a long history of criminal violence. In fact, the only thing they proved was that he shot a neighbor's dog years earlier from 75 to 100 yards away. And they proved that, and they proved that when he was arrested, he had another gun on him. He was carrying a gun. That was it. As far as any prior criminal record of him having a home record of violence or record of killing people, no record of that at all. In fact, he told his brothers, the one that testified for the state, the reason he killed these two guys is that dead men don't talk. So he killed them so they wouldn't tell on him about the attempted burglary. And then the other thing that apparently put the nail in the coffin, they used one of those typical state psychiatrists who testified on a hypothetical situation that a person who had done what Gary Johnson had done, be a future threat, was sociopathic, and be a future threat to be danger in the future. And they gave him the death penalty. And that's pretty much the facts.
That's the facts of the story. And then from there, we go to a trial. They were convicted, or at least Gary was convicted and given execution sentence. And his brother, no, Terry?
Terry.
Terry was given the execution.
No, Gary
got the execution, and Terry got a life. Would that have been a capital life without possibility of parole, or what?
Not
at that time.
Not at that time.
Not at that time. That was at that stage. So if we were on broadcast instead of HD2, Terry could well be listening to this story, the show tonight, and probably would be listening to this show tonight. Now, this case was tried in Huntsville, Texas. Even if there was no other evidence of violent behavior or other dangerousness, doesn't take much to get somebody to be considered a future threat in a Huntsville jury.
Not when he's killed two people or been involved in killing two people. And up in that part of the country, frankly, killing a dog, if it's a hunting dog, is a death penalty case.
Oh, absolutely. So, at least as far as the owner of that dog is
exactly
concerned.
Right.
That's the way that goes. And so Walker County is where this case was tried. I don't know if the Walker County District Attorney would have tried this case.
I would think with the murder of two people during the course of
it
a
would
murder,
take the full district attorney.
I think they'd probably try the death penalty case again because you have multiple murders. And see, the murders were done somewhat, not cavalier, but making a man come back and get on his hands and knees when he's begging for his life, shooting him in the mouth, is not the sort of thing that you're going to look over very easily. And I think they'd seek the death penalty again.
And there was some evidence that that's exactly the scenario,
scenario
that happened. That was Jim Skelton. Jim Skelton has had a lengthy history as a lawyer. He's been a prosecutor and he's been a defense lawyer. And his major pastime right now is to helping other defense lawyers keep up abreast with the new law. And Execution Watch is very fortunate to have him coming in here and sharing his thoughts with us about these cases. Is there anything unusual about the appeals of this case?
Yes. The most unusual thing is, as you well know, the way the appeal on death penalty case goes, you have a direct appeal, and that's automatic to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Usually it takes about a year, a year and a half, or 2 years at the maximum to go from direct appeal to get an opinion out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. Then once the Court of Criminal Appeals affirms the case, which they did, the state then, the defendant then will file a post-conviction writ of habeas corpus. What's interesting about that writ was pending for 8 years before it was decided. And that's what's really unusual. I was unable to, because the cases are so old, I went back to the archives of the Court of Criminal Appeals. I could not find an opinion, because the problem is, in many of these cases such as this, there are non-published opinions. And when they're non-published, they just kind of go and disappear into thin air after a certain passage of time. And I was unable to find anything as far as the issues were on direct appeal and as far as the issues were on the state writ. Obviously, something happened very odd, because normally, when a person files a post-conviction writ on a death penalty case within 6 months or a year, that's decided. That thing sat in the Court of Criminal Appeals for 8 years before they made a decision denying. And that's one reason you sat on death row so long, is that the appeal from the state writ was pending for so long. Then from that, of course, they go to the U.S. District Court on a federal writ, and of course, the District Court denied relief, one of them here in Houston. And then the First Circuit granted a certificate of appealability on two issues. So I went to the Fifth Circuit archives to try to find out what they granted appeal on. They didn't even publish it, and it wasn't even available on their website. And so there really are no opinions, no appellate opinions available, so you don't know what any of the issues were on appeal. Obviously, something was wrong, or they wouldn't spend 8 years fiddling around with the state writ. That's what's really odd about this case. That's why I was very curious to find why it took so long and who might have written the writ.
Now, that writ was to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals?
Right. The way it works, the direct appeal goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals. It's a 9-judge panel in Austin, Texas. And then what happens, they file a post-conviction writ, and the district court functions, it's filed in the district court where the conviction took place. And they function much like an investigative body. They gather evidence and make recommendations. That's all they do.
Now, this is the court that tried the case.
That's exactly right. It's called the convicting court. And so what happens, they don't make a decision on anything. They just simply gather evidence. And a lot of the times, what's happened here lately, when you file your writ and the state files a response, all that is sworn to and it's usually supported by affidavits, and they rarely ever have live hearings. They simply look at the affidavits on either side. The trial judge will make a recommendation to deny or grant the writ. Then it's sent to Austin. And Austin, to the 9-member court in criminal appeals in Austin. And that's where the little fish hook took place. Like I say, it's set up there. Usually those writs are back within the matter of 6 months or a year. But this one sat up there for 8 years before a decision was made.
And the decision was simply deny relief.
Right, it was denying relief. And I couldn't even find a record of what they said when they denied relief. I have no earthly idea why the court denied relief.
But then after that denial of relief came back, then things began to happen relatively
fast.
They
moved very fast after that. Because then you go to the U.S. District Court, file a federal writ there. And a large percentage of times they deny the writ and don't grant you a certificate of appealability, which means you got to get the trial judge to certify you got an appealable issue to get to the Fifth Circuit. Fifth Circuit did grant review on two issues, but I couldn't find out what those two issues were because I couldn't find any of the opinions. And then after they heard discussions on the two issues, they too denied relief. And of course, the Supreme Court denied hearing, refused to hear anything thereafter, as you well know.
And the Fifth Circuit acted on that between September the 9th of 2008 and January the 7th, 2009.
That's
so they
right.
Didn't spend a lot of time on that.
No. It went real fast. And like I say, the real unusual thing was that 8 years it was sitting in the Court of Criminal Appeals on a post-conviction record.
The Fifth Supreme Court of the United States did not review the Fifth Circuit's opinion.
They denied review of it, right.
All right. And then what? The trial court sets
a date? What happens, once say the Supreme Court decides they're not going to hear it, then at that point they start setting execution dates. And then the only thing you have at that point is an appeal for clemency is basically it. Now, you can go in and file a subsequent writ, but that's extremely hard to do because there has to be something new. For example, we've had a series of cases here recently where subsequent writs have been filed after all this procedure is over with based upon the Supreme Court case that you can't execute a mentally retarded person. But the only way you can file a second writ after a writ has been denied, this is both state and federal court, you got to show there was a change in law that occurred and the remedy was not available when you initially filed your writ. And that's basically it. And even if you discover new facts, the problem is they hold you to a real high standard. They said if you could have discovered those facts with due diligence when you first filed the writ, you're out of court. And so really it's only a change in law that gives you a second writ.
And so that retardation issue, and perhaps if the Supreme Court decides to do something about mental illness at a future date, that'll just reshuffle every deck in the game.
Right. Now, what they did file a writ in Supreme Court trying to halt the execution, claiming he was blind and too ill to be executed. That's never been anything they've been very sympathetic about. The only thing they've done, if people have gone crazy while they're on death row, and there have been instances that if they are insane, you can't execute somebody. I'm not talking about insane at the time of the crime. I'm talking about somebody who went insane after they were put on death row, because that probably would drive a normal person mad. And they cannot execute a person unless he's sane. And that can stop an execution if somebody's sane. But in this case, they didn't say he was insane. They said he was in bad health and was almost blind. And the Supreme Court, I'm sure, is not very sympathetic with that, because as long as he can see the gurney, they're going to kill him.
Mercy. Pretty spooky.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the case that happened last week at all?
No, not at all. I was out of town.
Okay. Well, it seems to me it's almost a hurry up and catch up kind of routine, because recent legal action in that case seemed pretty slim. Of course, I'm not as qualified to dig into that as thoroughly as you are, so I have to depend upon the work of the anti-death penalty lawyers and all of that, and that was pretty shallow. And this case doesn't seem to me like, after the lengthy delay at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, it was Katie bar the door. It's wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
Well, the case was pretty cut and dried. When you have a case in which the major witnesses for the state are your three brothers, and you've made admissions to your three brothers about doing the killing and tell your brothers the details of what happened, that's how they learned about the gun in the mouth. That came from one of the three brothers. That's how they learned that the purpose for killing the two men was dead men don't talk. The words that he spoke to his brother came back and convicted him.
So this is not a lot of meat in his bone anyway.
Not any meat at all. Plus, you can't say the brothers were lying, because the gun that Johnson gave to his three brothers ended up being, by ballistic proof, being one of the murder weapons. They didn't find the second weapon that was used in this case, but they found the weapon that they put in Johnson's hands through his brother as an admission of doing the killing, and then ballistics tied the weapon to the bullet found in the body of the victim. So there's no meat on the bone. It's all bone.
And as cases in Texas go, that's sufficient so that tonight's execution proceeds.
Here's the problem, Ray. When they executed Lawrence O'Brien, the candy killer, that was the case that really messed up death penalty cases, because he had absolutely no criminal record.
Zero.
Not a traffic ticket. Church member. I mean, he was generous with his money. That's one of the reasons he got into financial problems, because he was embezzling money from TSO to give it to this church.
Yeah.
And he had zero, I mean, nothing. And everybody thought there was no evidence of future dangerousness. There wasn't even a psychiatrist that said he would kill in the future. Nothing. And what the court said, and to justify affirming that case and giving him the death penalty, you can take the facts of the crime itself and use that to estimate that he would be a future danger in the future. So if you can take the crime that you're convicted of, and in this case, you have two murders of two men, one of which was a gunshot in the mouth after a guy's begging for his life. They can take those facts alone. That will be sufficient proof to show future dangerousness and sufficient to give a death penalty. And when Larry O'Brien case was affirmed, it just crushed most lawyers, because we kept thinking there had to be some sort of proof at punishment of future dangerousness. But they simply said you could take the facts of the case and use that to predict he'd be a danger in the future. And basically what they're saying, you committed this horrible, heinous act, and you're just not going to live, period, is what they basically said.
Yeah, and the O'Brien case is responsible for that change in law?
Exactly, because the likelihood of O'Brien killing one of his children is almost impossible.
He didn't have an emergency.
No. And that's what really messed up the death penalty law in Texas, because when they affirmed that case and said there was sufficient evidence to the future dangerousness based upon the act, that really messed up all the lawyers.
What we're waiting on, as Jim and I are talking about this case, we're waiting on Elizabeth to give us word that something has happened either in Huntsville or connect us with one of the other vigilants. We're expecting to hear from Rich Woodard. Woodward, he is in College Station at the vigil by the Bryan Valley chapter of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Gloria is in Huntsville, and she's with the Abolition Movement, and you can find out about them at abolitionmovementweekly.com. That's abolitionmovement.weekly.com. And then we can... we're going to hear shortly from Leo Freeman, and Leo Freeman was assisted in his case by the famous former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. So Leo is kind of the boots on the ground in the death penalty movement around here, because he has been a guest on this show before. He'll be on this evening, and he spent 8.5 years on death row before, with the assistance of Ramsey Clark. He got his sentence reduced to prison time, and he is now maxed out that time and got out in March of 2009. I'm Ray Hill, and with me in the studio is Jim Skelton. Elizabeth has come in and grabbed her notes and headed off to get in touch with Gloria or Rich or one of our call-in guests. The next scheduled execution is scheduled for February the 24th. So we've got a nice sabbatical now coming up until February the 4th. And that 24th, and that is Hank Skinner. Hank Skinner has an innocence claim, and you will be learning more about that. And you can learn more about it now by going to executionwatch.org. That's www.executionwatch.org, and you can find out about that. And Gloria, are you there? Gloria. Hello, Gloria, you're on.
I'm on.
She's been chanting.
Huh?
You've been chanting.
Yes. Well, I was talking. The media has come out. Three of them came out. So I'm curious to see. Apparently the execution is over.
Apparently the process has begun. It's hard for me to say the execution, but killing has happened, and it's been a process. And tonight's, it was Gary James Johnson, 59, was in the process. We learned recently that Gary's have a myriad of health problems and is either blind or nearly blind. A large group?
The American Law Institute, which is this, you know, prestigious body of lawyers and judges and law professors who actually put on paper the methodology or the whatever for execution, which is what the Supreme Court used back in the 70s when they reinstated it, has dissolved because they're no longer controlling the machinery of death. So,
Texas is one of 35 states that have execution laws on the books. Not all of those use it, but there are 35 states. 15 states are currently without execution laws, including New Mexico, who, however, still has two inmates on death row from the previous law. At the high point of the executions was 1999. 98 people were executed, most of them in Texas. The following year, 2000, there was 85 people executed, and the number remained high. In 2008, that number was down to 37. However, in 2009, it jumped back up to 52. And this is national figures. And affected.
Well, the reason it jumped back up last year was because in 2008, there were very few executions the first 5 months of the year. Because the government was
We'll see if you can find it out and report it to us on Friday night's prison show. Okay. Gloria, tell us how people can get in touch with the abolition movement. She's busy talking to witnesses, and she's being Lois Lane. No, you can't say that on television.
People can get in touch with our organization by calling 713-503-2633, or they can email us at abolition.movement@hotmail.com. There was definitely, there's like 20, how weird, 20 or 25 people that just came out.
Not family, not family, not media, but exceptional witnesses.
Oh, they look like a bunch of Yahoos. I believe this guy was African-American.
Okay.
I don't know what was going on. I have a feeling it's a train lettuce or somebody.
Okay. All right, Gloria.
Okay. Well, thank you all for...
Thank you, and we'll see you...
...with execution watch.
We'll see you Friday.
Okay,
and that was Gloria Ruback of the Abolition Movement, and glad to have her on with a report from Huntsville. We have reports coming in from Leo Friedman and Leo Freeman and Rich Woodard. Rich Woodard is at the vigil at College Station. I'm Ray Hill, and in the studio with me is Jim Skelton. Producer of the show is always Elizabeth Stein. She's running back and forth. Otis is the technical director. This was going to be our first show in the new studio, but it was not telephone capable yet. So they've got to put a telephone line over there. Otherwise, we would be over there, and a significant part of our show comes in telephone. Here comes Elizabeth, and I'm going to let Elizabeth do the buttons tonight. And hello, you're on the air. Who is this? Hey, Richard, what's going on in College Station? How does the vigil manifest in Brazos Valley?
We have a spot that's located directly across from the entrance to the Texas A&M campus.
Mm-hmm.
And we get there at about 5:30. I'm trying to capitalize on the time a lot of people getting out of work and driving out of campus and across.
Are most of the participants students?
No, most of the folks are actually members of the community. We have some students that are there regularly, some faculty, some people that have no affiliation with the university at all.
And why do you think most folks participate?
I don't know. I think there's a
why do you participate? And yours?
Sorry?
And your reason? And are you optimistic, pessimistic about doing something about this horror?
Absolutely, I'm optimistic. I mean, I'm optimistic and realistic. It is a long struggle, but I strongly believe that we are making progress. I think the fact that executions are down, and particularly the fact that the sentencing is down, a very favorable sign, and will the people of the state of Texas will begin to realize that it's just not an essential part of our capital or judicial system. But it's going to be a long road, and I always tell people when I'm standing out there and you wonder on these cold days sometimes or really hot days whether it's worth standing out there, I say, well, there's two ways to eliminate the death penalty. Either you get a judge to rule it unconstitutional, or you get a legislative change. And for that second road to eliminating death penalty runs through the corner on Texas Avenue across the A&M campus. You have to get popular opposition here. And I think as long as we keep working our way and convincing people of the failure of the death penalty, eventually we'll eliminate it.
And how do people get in touch with the Texas Coalition to Abolish Capital Punishment, even in Brazos Valley?
Well, you can find the links to us at the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty website. So that's TCADP.org.
TCADP.
TCADP, just the regular Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. There is a link to our local chapter on their website, and that's probably the
All right, give our regards to the other vigilants.
We will. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
All right,
and that was Rich Woodard of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, demonstrating at the vigil in College Station. And now we have my friend Leo Freeman. Hello, Leo.
How you doing, Ray?
Well, they treat me better than I deserve. How you getting along? Okay, we're looking forward to seeing you around the station. For those of you who are listening to this either on the internet or on HD2 channel, if you've ever had a prison number, or if you've worn a gray uniform and worked in a prison or had anything to do with that business, you're welcome in the prison show every Friday night after about 8 o'clock when we gather to do the prison show. Tell me, Leo, do you know about this case? You know this feller? Many years. Yeah, I used to get along pretty well with Gary, but then I wasn't an inmate, so. Me and two of the cure ladies went in to see him one day, and I went off on him. I just loaded up and went off on him, and here we were screaming at one another, waving our arms around, scared those ladies to death. But then that's the way Gary and I were, and after a reasonable period of that where I thought I'd gotten my point across and he got his point across, we settled down and then talked about serious business, and then ultimately got on the prison museum. And Gary and I both agreed that we needed to keep the history of Texas prisons for fear some future generation would make the same damn fool mistakes that we're all making now. Any thoughts about tonight's events?
Somebody kills a human being and then you come
You know, one of the things that I think I will do this Friday, because I got some special guests from out of town in Houston listening to the radio show this weekend, and one of the things I'm going to do is a lengthy editorial about revenge-based reactionary cultures. And I'm going to talk about somebody does you one, you got to do them one, then they got to up that and do you another one, then you got to up that and do them another one, and the cycle never ends unless somebody says, wait a minute, this ain't working. And execution is a part of that, but it's only a part of it. I'm dealing with a disciplinary case right now in a Texas prison situation where somebody complained about the temperature and got the ombudsman involved, and the captain had to sweat that and all of that. Then all of a sudden the captain said, this woman trying to run this institution, and so crushes her in a disciplinary thing that's basically all made up. And unless somebody understands what's going on and addresses that repetitive cycle. What are your thoughts on that, Leo? Okay, Leo, we're looking forward to seeing you Friday. I may leaf you into some of that discussion, if you don't mind.
Okay, well, I'll be there. I'll see you guys.
Come on down. I'll put you to work. That's happened before.
Yeah, that is.
Thank you, bro.
You're welcome, bro. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now I'm back with Jim. Jim, I got a question.
Sure.
What's a lawyer to do?
I don't want to rain anybody's parade, but let me tell you, I'm not as all optimistic as most people are that we're making progress in the death penalty. The reason we've had a decline in the number of death sentences are two reasons. Number one, county commissioners and counties are realizing it costs a whole lot of money to try a death penalty case. And money's a major factor because it costs, not only does the county have to provide at least two lawyers, and they will be paid $20,000 to $30,000 each, they also have to pay the lawyer for direct appeal, and a county will spend $100,000 to $150,000 to $200,000 just on legal fees. Then the Supreme Court had been pretty cranky, and they made them let us appoint experts, so that they runs up the bill even higher with experts. So the cost, plus the fact that you have a sentence of life without parole, which is in fact a death sentence, the fact that someone isn't executed by a needle or by hanging or by shooting him doesn't mean it that's the only way you kill somebody. If you put somebody in prison for life without parole, that is in fact the death penalty. And I'm not as nearly as optimistic as most people are about. I'm real excited because the numbers have gone down. The numbers have gone down because of money and because they can put people away for life without parole and accomplish the same thing with less money. So I'm not at all optimistic. I don't think our attitudes have changed that dramatically at all. I don't want to rain on anybody's parade.
No. I think you bring up some very valid points. And I think that needs to be part of the discussion of this, is that we're really not doing any better. It's just that we're doing it over a longer period of time.
We're doing it differently.
You're doing it differently, and it's slower. And so the immediate statistics, and a lot cheaper. The other side of that is, well, as long as they're alive, there's a possibility of either change or reform or something, or something being found wrong with the case to get it reversed. But actually, that wears off after a few years, doesn't it?
Because what happens, you run out of things to argue about after a while. And you asked earlier what a lawyer is to do. I think that you cannot separate the death penalty from prison reform. Because of what's in, but this is one of the unusual cases. Usually the people that end up on death row are the ones who have been raised in our institutions. We pretty well raised them. It's kind of like raising pigeons for a pigeon shoot, the way we treat prisoners. I think it all begins with some sort of penal reform. And I think we slowly should learn that you got to reform people within the community and not locking them up and live in some abnormal environment where they can't have any contact with family or loved ones. It's usually keep them out of trouble. As far as what a lawyer can do, the key thing, virtually all death penalty cases are won in two areas. One of them is at the punishment issue, where you've got to really do your homework. You've got to do your homework on what the case is about. You've got to do your homework on finding expert witnesses. And you've got to be ingenious presenting punishment. Well, excuse me, when they do life without parole, you have that option completely taken away. Because what happens in these cases, the moment they say guilty, that ends the case. There's no separate hearing on punishment. It's automatically life. And so probably the area that's most fruitful for lawyers is a punishment hearing, where you really have a chance to do something. Because
so actually the reason reforms of this business of life without parole is taking some options away.
Taking your greatest option. In fact, the only two places is a general rule that you're going to find reversible error in death penalty cases is during the jury selection, when they use racial discrimination things, do things of that nature. You can find sometimes error in jury selection. And that's one fruitful area, but then by far the most fruitful area has been in the punishment hearing. Well, life without parole knocks that out. And then all you've got left, really, is error committed. In fact, the voir dire is even limited, because in a voir dire in a capital murder case, you're seeking the death penalty, will take usually 2 months to select a jury. Whereas a voir dire in a capital murder where they waive the death penalty will take at the most a day. So you knock out the voir dire from 2 months to a day, and you can't do a thorough job on quizzing the jury. Number two, your best option, which is usually trying to develop something at punishment to try to humanize your client to show he shouldn't get the death penalty, that's been taken away because there's no punishment hearing. It's just an automatic, you're found guilty of capital murder, c'est la vie, and that's taken away. And so that's why I'm not at all optimistic about us making progress, because really this life without parole has eliminated two very valuable tools that defense lawyers have, and that's their rapport with the jury by jury selection. And number two, developing issues during the punishment to show them. See, you can't develop issues now to show that he deserves something other than life without parole. Like in a death penalty case, when you're seeking the death penalty, you have witnesses you can call, you have experts you can call to say that this man is not death worthy. But you haven't got the same sort of tools that say that he's not worthy of being executed by old age. And that's what life without parole amounts to. It's still a death sentence. It's just done by Mother Nature as opposed to a bunch of goobers putting him on a gurney and shooting him full of drugs. It's the only difference. You go from goober to Mother Nature, and that's the only damn difference.
Jim, you have a way of putting things that just kind of cut to the bone.
Well, that's the truth.
Your lawyers do that, you know. But the question about what's a lawyer to do, what if you had this case? Do you think you'd have done anything different from the lawyers in Walker County some 10 years ago?
I doubt it, seriously, because the problem you've got with this case are the three admissions to family members, and they came and testified for the state. And generally, when somebody testifies against a defendant in a capital murder case, he's a co-defender, has some culpability. These brothers had no culpability, and their confession was shorn up by the fact that the gun was being used. And then the people he killed were apparently fairly well respected. They were fairly young men. And you do the old Percy Farman trick. You try to prove that the son of a bitch needed killing.
Yeah.
But when they're young like that, and then you have the additional factor. Texas is just peculiar about this. they have very little sympathy for thieves. And all of this was based upon the fact that somebody was going to come to a ranch and steal something.
Yeah.
And that makes it even worse when you're a former employee. That makes it even more egregious.
That's thievery and disloyalty.
In East Texas, when you steal from the guy that hired you and paid your money and you kill somebody's dog, those facts alone will get you the death penalty.
Every time.
If you add to it the fact that two men are killed, they'll dig you out of your grave and kill you again if they could do it.
I hate to be laughing at this, but the fact of the matter is there is a considerable evidence of the truthfulness in which you speak. So after these guys made this damn fool mistake and decided to go in there and wound up doing this incredibly stupid thing, it was Walker County, or it was just reality and karma that they weren't going to get a break?
No. And I would imagine that those people that came down there in cowboy boots and cowboy hats were cops that, you know, and they were also probably some rancher-type people, some of your basic redneck.
Yeah, probably local Grange organization.
Right. And, you know, that's the word. And you talk about getting no sympathy from people like that. And then the fact that they were stealing on that.
They could have been the jurors, actually.
Probably could have been. And, you know, and what can you steal? When you think about it, what in the world can you steal at a ranch? I mean, they're not going to have a bunch of electronics and stuff at a ranch.
Some castrating thongs.
I guess you could do that. Maybe some cattle cake or something like that. Just so stupid. In fact, when I was reading this, I kept thinking of my old theory that years ago, the real crazy bad people came from Kansas and Missouri. That's where all the bad outlaws came from. And I think it has something to do with born in a rectangular state. It does something to your brains. And these guys come down here, and it's kind of like those people that came over here from New Orleans. They didn't realize that Houston's a whole different environment than New Orleans.
That's right.
In fact, the ones the drug dealers didn't kill, the cops put in jail and beat up. That's why there's no population left in New Orleans, because the Houston drug dealers killed most of them, and then the cops got the rest of them. That's why they can't go back. There ain't nothing left to go. There's not there anymore. And so, like I say, and that would be an extremely difficult case to defend. And they're obviously, and I don't know what deals might have been made, but usually family members aren't willing to come forward and testify, especially when one's going to get the death penalty. And these brothers apparently came forward and agreed to testify for the state in a capital case against their own brother. So that tells you something about the character of the person that was executed.
That was the inimitable and irreplaceable Jim Skelton giving you the wit and the wisdom of the day. My name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. You either heard it on KPFT Houston's HD2 channel, or you heard it on the internet at executionwatch.org. Tell your friends where it can be found, because actually this program will survive in the archive into the future. It would not have been possible for us to cover the execution of Gary James Johnson, 59. He is now dead. They're taking his body to the Huntsville Funeral Home, where any family members who desire can go feel the warmth of that body while that warmth lasts. I know that sounds morbid, but that is a frequent thing that happens after people have been executed in Texas, because their families have not been able to touch them for frequently, in this case, many years. Jim Skelton is our legal authority and, of course, our commentator on justice in Texas and optimism or pessimism toward the end of executions, and a good definition, I think, of life without hope of parole. Tonight, I never do one of these programs that I don't learn something, usually from Jim. It was good to have Leo Freeman on. Leo Freeman has actually lived in the belly of the beast. He served 8.5 years on Texas death row before being transferred to general population after his sentence was commuted, and he got out of that. He was convicted and sent to prison in 1973, and he got out in March of 2009. You do the arithmetic. Our reporter from the Death House Vigil was Gloria Ruback. She's a regular on the prison show, and we will see her, and you can find out more about her organization at www.abolitionmovement.com and
weebly.com.
Weebly. Not a K, it's a B. All right. Dyslexic Ray. Usually Professor Longmire is that vigilant up there in Huntsville, but he had the night off, though I understand from Gloria's report he was there. Rich Woodward joined us for the first time tonight. Rich Woodward and his spouse, his wife, is are members of Brazos Valley chapter of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and the acronym of that .org will work for their website. Our producer, of course, is the Elizabeth Ann Stein, who you hear from time to time in the background, who makes things happen. None of this would be possible with the elaborate technology of HD2 radio if it were not for Otis McClay. The theme music that begins every show is written and performed by Victoria Panetti. And she can be found at www.myspace.com/shemonster. And, of course, I'm Ray Hill, and I can be found here when there's an execution. The next one is scheduled for February the 24th, where they plan to execute Hank Skinner. Details of that case can be found on our website, www.executionwatch.org. We're going to go out with a few minutes of music. I want to thank the management and the staff of KPFT for allowing us to do this show. And this work continues as long as Texas kills. Thank you and good night.
Are we not hearing this?
Yes, we're hearing it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.